It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in Wisconsin Life, we'll learn about an effort to restore tribal traditions in the Ojibwe Winter Games, including a sport that hadn't been played for 175 years.
First, two pieces of news from space caught our attention lately. Last week, NASA's Kepler project announced the discovery of over 700 planets around the galaxy.
And NASA is working toward the goal of capturing an asteroid. And last month, they unveiled the first steps toward figuring out which asteroid to grab.
Joining us now to talk about the latest news from space is Richard Talcott, senior editor at Astronomy Magazine. Rich, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So 715 newly discovered planets, some of them are supposed to be quite habitable. How exciting is this news?
It's really exciting, and the reason is because until now we'd only known of about 1,000 planets outside of our own solar system, and so with one fell swoop we've increased the number of known planets by 70%. So that's a huge increase, and we're starting to see planets that are more like Earth. We haven't yet found any that are exactly like Earth, and certainly we haven't found life elsewhere in the galaxy. But we're starting to get closer and closer to being able to learn those kinds of answers.
Are we getting better and better at detecting these planets?
Well, the reason we got 700 some odd right now is because there's been a space telescope out orbiting Earth called Kepler, and it's been looking for these planets for the last 3 to 4 years. And the thing that it's been doing is staring at one spot in the sky and monitoring about 150,000 stars, looking for planets that pass in front of each of those. And so this mission is a great way to find a whole bunch of planets in a small area of sky, whereas other people that are on the ground are searching more piecemeal by looking at one star at a time and trying to find planets. So this spacecraft has been a real boon to finding planets outside our solar system.
And it sounds like there is this complex mathematical formula that helps it all come together. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. It's not really a complex mathematical formula, but probably one thing that we should say is we don't know precisely how many new planets are discovered because it's kind of done in a statistical way. And basically what it is that astronomers have learned that if you look at one star and find at least one planet that they can confirm going around it, the odds are that any other signals that might look like a planet are also planets. One analogy that I heard that I thought was pretty good is if you imagine you're on the African savanna and looking for male lions, adult males, tend to travel by themselves, whereas their female pride tend to gather together. And so if you see a group of about 10 or 20 different lions, the odds are that almost all of them are going to be lionesses, in other words, female lions, instead of the males, because there should only be one there. And it's the same kind of thing here, where if you find 7 or 8 planet candidates going around one star and you've confirmed that one of them is a planet, the odds are that all the other ones are going to be as well. And so, although it may only be 98 or 99% sure that each of these 715 new objects are planets, that still bumps the number up by a good 700 or so.
It used to be that this is kind of like terra incognita. You look at a map and there's a gray area and some question marks. Is this changing the way we think about the rest of our galaxy, the rest of our universe?
Certainly in some respects, and a large part of that is because until, say, 15, 20 years ago, astronomers didn't know that there were any other planets in our galaxy or the universe, for that matter. They certainly thought that they should be out there, but one of the assumptions they made is that, well, we have our solar system here with some small rocky planets near the sun and some giant gaseous planets farther away. The idea was is that when we looked at other stars and finally started seeing these planets, that they'd kind of mimic that. And that was thrown for a total loop with the first few planets that were discovered, which were the size of Jupiter and made out of gas, yet they were orbiting inside where Mercury orbits the sun. And so that kind of threw things threw astronomers for a loop, and the same things happened a few different times in the past, so that it turns out that there aren't all that many solar systems that we've discovered so far elsewhere that mimic what ours looks like. And that's been probably the big change that's come from astronomers thinking about what's going on out there.
Now, you mentioned that what we're seeing is some potential Earth-like planets. Can you flesh that out a little? What sorts of planets are you finding that are resembling Earth?
Well, the way that astronomers find planets nowadays, and even with the Kepler Space Telescope, it's much, much easier to find planets that orbit close to their stars and planets that weigh a lot, because the ones that weigh a lot tend to have bigger effects on their star that we can see a little bit easier. And so for a long time, well, long time being 15, 20 years, they've been finding fairly large planets fairly close in to their stars, which is not what we have here in our solar system, where Earth, for instance, is fairly small relative to the size of normal planets, and it orbits fairly a little bit farther out than what they normally have found. And so as the techniques have gotten better and they've been observing for longer times, we've been able to find more planets that are farther away from their stars, out more where Earth and some of the more distant planets would be, and also to find smaller stars which don't have as much of an effect on their star, but that kind of builds up over time during the observations. So as time has gone on, we've been finding more of these kinds of planets that are closer to resembling Earth, and we actually have found some that are Earth-sized, but not those that sit right where we would want them to, and also finding planets in what's called the habitable zone. And that's just a shorthand or a longhand way for astronomers to say regions around their star where water could exist on the surface of a rocky planet. And so they're finding planets that are closer in size to Earth and ones that are orbiting inside the habitable zones. That is leading astronomers to think that perhaps the conditions that created life here on Earth might be found throughout the galaxy.
This is a big discovery, over 700 planets. But is it, are astronomers getting the feeling that that's just a little slice of what's out there as we look more and more?
Oh, certainly. There is approximately 200 billion stars in our galaxy, and so far we've found planets around probably about 1,000 of those. But astronomers think that probably at least 10%, if not more, of the stars in our galaxy actually do have planets. And so there's probably millions, if not billions, more to find out there. It just turns out that it's hard to find the farther they get away from Earth, and makes it harder to observe those.
Now, this is extrapolating out a little bit, but this cache of 715 planets, and obviously we usually get the most excited when there is one that resembles Earth. Can you talk a little bit about why it is we get more excited about Earth-like planets? Is it because we want to go there in an escape pod, or it makes us feel good? What is the psychology behind that?
Well, I think the psychology is more a case of wanting to find spots in the universe where life may exist. It's always difficult to extrapolate from one example, which is what we have here on Earth. And I mentioned a little bit ago that astronomers just kind of naturally assumed that the other planet systems we'd find in our galaxy would resemble ours. And it turns out that they did, that in most cases they haven't. The same kind of thing could happen as far as life goes, that life here on Earth could be significantly different than life elsewhere in the galaxy. And only by finding these areas where life exists are they going to be able to go out and get a better handle on how life may evolve on other worlds.
We're talking to Rich Talkett, senior editor at Astronomy Magazine, looking at some of the latest news about planets, asteroids, and more. Coming up, we're going to talk about an effort to capture an asteroid.
We continue our conversation now about the latest space news, from the discovery of more new planets to an effort to grab an asteroid. Richard Talcott from Astronomy Magazine is with us, and you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And Rich, let's talk about this asteroid thing. So NASA is in the midst of an effort to capture an asteroid. How do you go about doing that?
Well, it's kind of interesting, actually. Probably in most people's mind, they think of astronauts going out and grabbing an asteroid and blowing it up or something, if you watched Armageddon or some of the other great movies of the last decade or two. But that's not really what NASA has in mind. What they hope to do is to send a robotic spacecraft out to a small asteroid that's not too far away from Earth, and they haven't settled on a specific target yet. yet, but they'll, over the next probably 5 to 10 years, will narrow it down so that they can figure out which one would be the best one to grab. They'll send out an unmanned spacecraft, and basically what it'll do is it will have a large garbage bag with it, made out of something similar to plastic, and they'll wrap the asteroid in this large plastic bag and then tow it back into near Earth and Moon and probably put it into orbit around the Moon. And then once that they have it in that position, what the plan is to send astronauts up to this asteroid where they can examine it up close, collect rock samples, bring those samples back to Earth, and do a whole bunch of other tests on it to see exactly what it's made out of and how it's put together.
How big an asteroid are we talking about here?
Well, as far as asteroids go, it's pretty small. The largest asteroids that are out there are on the order of a few hundred miles across. And what they're looking for is probably something in the range of 25 to 30 feet in diameter. So something that's pretty manageable in terms of being able to grab it and bring it back. Just to give you an example, you may remember the meteor that exploded over Russia just about a year ago now in February. And it was about twice as large as the asteroid that the astronomers at NASA are looking to grab a hold of.
So I'm fixating on this plastic bag thing. So are you just saying that so that we'll understand it? Or is this literally a plastic bag like I've got in my garbage can?
Well, it's a little bit more complex than that because they want to make sure it's something that won't rip and tear if the because probably the asteroid will have sharp edges and sharp rocks on it and things like that. So it's going to have to be a little bit heavier than your typical Glad or Hefty bag that you put in your garbage.
That's a relief.
But it's not going to have to be. That's a pretty good analogy for the kind of thing it is. I mean, it's the kind of thing where they want to put it completely around the asteroid and then cinch it closed like you would a garbage bag so that they can carry it back to the Earth-Moon system.
Okay, and this isn't a sign that NASA really needs funding.
Well,
this is what they want to be using.
It probably will require some money, but it'll require less money than if they actually sent astronauts out to the asteroid or sent astronauts out to the asteroid directly.
Uh-huh.
So
it'll
be a little bit cheaper than that.
There's been a lot of talk lately over the last century about Mars as a target of space exploration. What are the benefits of an asteroid versus focusing on another planet?
Well, there are good arguments to be made for both. I think most astronomers would say that going to Mars would be much more interesting because there's the possibility that life may have once gotten started out on the red planet. And so certainly being able to examine it up close would be really cool. But the asteroid has its own advantages, among them the fact that they're a lot easier to get to. If you're talking about a near-Earth asteroid, in other words, one whose orbit is pretty close to Earth, it doesn't require anywhere near as much fuel to get out there and grab it as it would to go to Mars. You aren't exposing astronauts to a couple of years of radiation in space that you would when you're going to Mars. And so it's a much easier task to go out and grab an asteroid than it is to try to send a crew all the way to Mars and back.
So let's say NASA's successful in capturing this asteroid. What is the Holy Grail about what we might learn from it?
Well, one of the things that worries NASA and most people that tend to think about it is that one of these days Earth is going to be hit by a fairly large one of these near-Earth asteroids. And the reason we know that that's going to happen is because it's happened multiple times over the past millions and billions of years that Earth's been in existence. There's lots of craters, many of which have been eroded so that they're kind of hard to tell, but there are lots of craters here on Earth that tell that we've been hit by fairly large projectiles. And these large projectiles can actually do damage. They rate them as nothing to worry about or regional disasters up to civilization enders. And in fact, most scientists think that a large asteroid impacted probably about 65 million years ago and helped wipe out the dinosaurs. So they can certainly do much harm to life here on Earth. So what NASA wants to do is to learn as much about these kinds of objects as they can so that they can better understand them and better figure out better ways in which to deflect or eliminate the problem if they do find one that's on a collision course with Earth.
On a more positive note, I've seen some speculation, and this has been a standby in science fiction over the years, of capturing a little larger asteroid, parking in orbit, and using it as a stepping stone to exploring further out in space.
That's true. One of the things that makes going out into space difficult is because astronauts or equipment and cargo have to be pushed out of Earth's gravity. And that's pretty difficult to do because Earth has a lot of gravity compared with even the moon and certainly relative to one of these asteroids. So if you send cargo out to an asteroid, for instance, it's much easier to get on and off of the asteroid than it is to get on and off of Earth. And so you can get a lot more materials out into space if you're working from something that's already in space.
You make it sound as though these asteroids are not moving terribly quickly. I just saw gravity and the vision of things hurtling through space at incredible velocities is in my head. Is that true? How fast are these things moving?
Well, they're moving pretty fast, and it depends on what kind of frame of reference you're using. If you're actually orbiting in the International Space Station, for instance, and you come across a piece of debris from a previous spacecraft, it's not tending to move all that fast because all the things there are moving relatively similar speeds. But if you're talking about an object coming in from outside the solar system, most of those are moving at speeds of a few thousand miles an hour. So they're trucking along pretty well. And if one of those should happen to hit Earth, we could be in trouble.
Just briefly before we're done, I heard we have a lunar eclipse coming up soon.
Yeah, up in the middle of April, actually, on the night of April 14th into the morning of April 15th. The moon's going to be passing through Earth's shadow for the first time since December 2011. So it's been almost 2.5 years since we've seen any total lunar eclipse. It should be a pretty spectacular view. And if we're lucky, it'll be a little bit warmer by mid-April than it is now.
If we're lucky.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea if we'll be able to see it here in Wisconsin?
Yes, the whole thing will be visible from here in Wisconsin, starting right around midnight and going into the wee hours.
All right, Rich, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure, glad to.
That was Richard Talcott, senior editor for Astronomy Magazine. It's time for Wisconsin Life. On a frozen lake in the North Woods, one man is working to bring long-lost Native American traditions back to life. Producer Tegan Wendland attended the third annual Ojibwe Winter Games on the Lac des Flambeaux Indian Reservation.
Wayne Valier, an educator and member of the Lac des Flambeaux Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, says some of these games haven't been played for over 100 years, and he feels it's his responsibility to teach them to the young people.
I'm trying to bring an awareness of our native games and our native values and our native customs, our native culture, our language, so that we never forget again.
On a warm and breezy morning, a group of about 30 eighth graders head out onto the frozen snowy lake to learn about their traditions. They start with a simple snowshoe race.
On your mark! Get set! Go! Go!
But Valier says the games aren't just about having fun.
The children are trained at a young age how to survive in this environment. They're taught to be hunters and gatherers through these games. So the mission of the games is actually to teach our kids how to use the tools of war as well as survival.
14-year-old Dallas Hart says for him, spear throwing is not about the competition. It's about the feeling he gets.
When I run and throw it, I can feel the power going through my arm and into the arrow and see how far it flies.
Oh man.
But when it flies far, then it feels pretty good because then you know that you can, then you know that you're a hunter or warrior, because when you throw the arrow farther, you have the strength to hunt.
The game Valier is most proud of is
Guni Ka Ganebig, the snow snake game.
He did a lot of research to bring this game back to life. It hasn't been played by the Ojibwe for more than 175 years. The players take a weighted spear, carved like a snake, and slide it down a path of ice where the snow has been cleared away.
The game was banished by the Europeans. A few generations later, people forgot the game. I brought the game back, and now the people know the game again, and we're sliding those snakes again, once again, on the ice.
Get down and slide it. Get down low.
Like that. Like just like that.
Oh, boy.
Awesome, Trey. Just like that.
Oh, he made that face.
Eighth grade teacher Hannah Bigjohn says the traditional games and shared sense of identity bring the students together.
I've seen cooperation between some of these students who don't talk in the classroom. They don't encourage one another. outside of school, and then suddenly we're here and you can hear shouts of encouragement. It's amazing.
Valier says that doesn't surprise him.
By knowing where we've been as a people, we'll have a better understanding on where we're going in the future. Planting the seed of identity, historical identity, who we are as a people. It's a very respectful way to live, respect of all living things.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode was produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org or find them on Facebook.
Wayne Valier joins us now for more on the Ojibwe Winter Games and traditions that surround them. Wayne, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
What got you started trying to revive these traditions?
Pardon me? I didn't hear you.
How did you get started? Why did you try to revive these traditions in the Ojibwe Winter Games?
Well, like I said before, there were games that hadn't been played in our tribe and our band for a long time. And I felt that they were part of our identity of the past. And like I've stated before, by knowing our past, we have a better understanding of where we're going in the future as a people. So after talking with some elders many years back about the games and different equipment and how they were made and stuff, I went on and did my own research. After that, I decided to make the sporting equipment and start the games and teach the students the Ojibwe Mo'in that go with the games as well as its history. And today, after 3 years of our third annual games, the students now are taking ownership of Ojibwe Winter Games.
Are your students starting to teach other people now?
Yes, they. I have a few students that are very involved in it that are learning quite a bit and are sharing with the younger students some of the techniques and some of the history about the games.
How did you research the snow snake game?
Well, I actually talked to some of my elders on different nearing Ojibwe bands and what they knew about the games, and also researched some of the historical papers of Ojibwe in this region by different authors like John George Cole and Rissenthaler and Warren and different writers that have written about the history of the Ojibwe and pieced together memoirs and papers and different authors, different dates and times and how the game was played. Then after cross-referencing the information with my elders, we went ahead and started the game.
What was it like the first time you played the snow snake game, knowing that no Ojibwe had played it in 175 years?
I'd have to say that word in my native language, and that word is Mamaka Dandum, and what that word means is an amazing thing. It was like my ancestors reaching back from the past and blessing us in these times, letting us know that our culture is still alive and well.
Working with kids, was this an amazing thing for them too?
Yes, they took to it. Like a duck takes the water, the kids, like I said, they took ownership of the games, and these games are they belong to Native people. They were Indigenous games that were played with our young people as well as the old people, and so it's the identity thing, and it brings Native pride to the students playing snow snake rather than basketball or football or some of these other athletic games. These games take a lot of skill.
Are other bands of Ojibwe coming to you and maybe going to pick up these traditions too?
Yes, there are some bands out there that are doing some of different parts of the games, but like I said, doing the research, there are no bands in the Midwest that I know of that are doing something like the Ojibwe Winter Games, where we have a multitude of cultural activities happening for elementary students. And we as a tribe and cultural people, we believe that our culture lives in our younger people. It doesn't live on some CD-ROM on a dusty shelf or a book in some library. Our culture is alive, and in order to keep it alive, we have to teach it to our children so they can pass it on to their children.
You've also worked on the tradition of birch bark canoes. Can you tell us about what you've done with that?
I've been studying birch bark canoe building since I was probably 14 years old. Worked with some elders learning the craft, and then later on started to build my own canoes. I built my first canoe when I was 16 years old, and then talking to some of the builders, and some of those builders aren't alive right now. Today in the Midwest, we have quite a few non-native builders, but there's only a handful of Native American birch bark canoe builders, Ojibwe birch bark canoe builders in the Midwest left today. So it is a dying culture amongst the Anishinaabe in the Midwest. We're trying to bring the canoe culture back, because it is a signature of Waswagoning, of Lac des Flambeaux. We have 268 lakes on our reserve. We came into this area because of its water. The birch bark canoe was a signature of my people, the way they were constructed, and they were used throughout the seasons for everything from traveling to trapping to hunting to fishing to ricing. So it played a major role in the existence of the Anishinaabe with my band. So that culture that was lost probably in the 30s is when the last Lac des Flambeaux canoe builders were alive. So we brought it back, my older brother, Leanne Valier, and myself and our community. And we have some young people very interested in picking up the craft.
Wayne, thank you so much for joining us. I hope we can talk to you again sometime.
Pleasure's mine.
That was Wayne Valier, artist and Ojibwe language and culture educator at Lac des Flambeaux Public School and the Lac des Flambeaux Indian Reservation in northern Wisconsin. We've been talking about the Ojibwe Winter Games.